Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
I think it's that nowadays people are interested in food, kind of certainly people a lot more kind of food, would identify themselves as foodies, wouldn't they, nowadays?
Yeah.
Whereas possibly a few years ago they might not. I think a lot of people pay a lot more attention, so hopefully it's just a natural progression to paying attention to historical food.
Indeed. Hello, welcome back to part two of our episode about Apicius. Yesterday, we've seen a lot about Apicius' life and death. Now sit back, relax, and enjoy the rest of the story.
And then the other thing I did to kind of whittle down which recipes to go for. So the ones, not necessarily the ones that told a story, but with the ones named after him, because there's only about a dozen that have his name. And I kind of thought, well, that seems as good a good a way as any to pick, because it's from Quirus. That gives you quite a good slice from slice through the cookbook. So you've got things like Apician Conchicla, which is a dish involving pork and peas. I mean, there's about three different types, and Lucanicae and pork meatballs, and that was quite a good introductory dish for me. And then you've got things like the patina, the minotau, which is like a stew.
Yes.
And I mean, again, I was leaving out the testicles and the sweet. So Sainsbury's didn't have.
Strange that.
Okay. Exactly.
Yeah, my Sainsbury's doesn't have it either. So, you're mentioning the pork and the peas. I mean, to anybody that cooked once or twice in their life, I mean, it sounds like a great combination already. Peas and pork. I mean, we have something similar nowadays, like pea and ham soup, for example. So it doesn't seem to be out of. It doesn't seem to be too alien, really, does it?
And I think there's. I mean, it helps that there's so many recipes to choose from that you can. There's a lot. I mean, like I said, there's a lot to be that's unfamiliar. If you're used to a modern recipe, when you see these ancient recipes, but then there's a lot of familiar things like the pork and peas. It's cooking peas in a saucepan with a couple of different types of ham, with some spices, most of which are familiar. I mean, you know, it's ground pepper, it's oregano, it's dill, it's coriander. It's all stuff that we would. I mean, it's only occasionally you have to go out of your comfort zone and get mastic, for example, or lovage, or stuff like that.
Yeah, lovage is the one that it's difficult to find the seeds.
Although celery seeds is apparently quite similar. That's what I ended up using as a substitute quite a lot of the time.
Good tip. I'm using celery seeds sometimes, but I'm growing lavage in my garden. so I've got I'm going to that length.
But then stuff like the garum, and I think you've talked about this before, the kind of the Thai fish sauce is probably not exactly the same, but it's passable. It adds the same kind of umami texture that I imagine you'd have got from the Roman equivalent.
Yeah. I mean, I've done a whole episode about garum, which covers all the possibilities and all the ways that whatever the archaeologists and the food historians, you know, found and they came up with. And obviously what we know from the modern Thai fish sauce and Vietnamese fish sauce. And also I think Sally Granger did more in-depth, you know, trying to find out about Gar Moore and all that stuff. So yeah, I was based a lot on her research about garum and how it's familiar to, you know, the modern fish sauce and so on. And also the restaurant Noma in Denmark, one of maybe the best restaurant in the world, apparently. They do a lot of different garums. So they have a book about fermentation, and in the book about fermentation, they have about 10 recipes of garum, how to make your own garum at home. And yeah, fish garum and shrimp garum and even meat garum. And they've gone to other extreme lengths of of making this fermented.
Did you try and ferment your own garum?
I haven't yet.
That was where I drew the line as well. Awful, yeah. And making my own garum. I thought it might test the bounds of my relationship a little bit too much.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, I was forcing my partner to eat to eat a lot of this Roman cooking. And he's sometimes suspicious on the best of times of my cuisine. Yes. Probably. You can imagine the comments from the neighbours if you had all the fermenting fish guts out the back of the out in the back garden.
Oh God, yes. I'm looking forward to it actually.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, that's one of my regrets. Is I didn't really get a chance to delve into Roman bread. I think that would be quite. There's quite a few recipes. I don't think there's not really any recipes in Apicius for bread beyond the flatbread. I think it's used on one occasion, but there certainly are recipes for Roman bread floating around that I'd have loved to have tried out as part of this project, but I never got around to. I want to come back to.
Yeah, I think I definitely haven't done enough with Roman breads or ancient.
It's the whole episode there, maybe ancient breads.
Yeah. I think not only episode. Yeah, I want to actually do some, you know, different recipes, experiment with different yeasts. Like, I think they used a lot of wine yeasts or grape yeasts. Yeah, which was obviously more easily available in a way. So much wine.
Yeah, I think a lot of the. You can see that in some of the recipes. A lot of it is obviously byproducts of various things. I think a lot of the sauces. One of the things Apicius is famous for is his sauces. Although it's not entirely in evidence in the actual cookbook, but I think a lot of that was sauces that would then go with leftover meat. So they might, you know, if they've done a big. I guess like we do today, if you've done a big. Pork roast, for example, you'll have a lot of leftovers. So yeah. it's then maybe sauces that are used with the leftovers. Yeah, so I mean that's one of the two things that I think it was Appian, one of the later writers, kind of comments that he's famous for is sauces and cakes, both of which are kind of lacking actually in his cookbook. Certainly cakes. Apparently he was famous for his cheesecakes, and unfortunately we don't have a recipe for cheesecakes. But I used. I made a couple of his sauces. So I was trying to cook mullet, because obviously in homage to his, the kind of story about him bidding
in
for
the fish market.
In the fish market, exactly. Yeah. And there's not so many recipes for mullet, but there are recipes for sauces to go with mullet. And one of the ones I made was a dill sauce, which is quite tasty, actually. It was just kind of pepper, which seems to be in all the cookbook, in all the recipes in Apicius, there's a lot of pepper involved. I think it was quite a new ingredient at the time. It was quite fashionable.
Yeah.
So there's pepper, there's dill seeds, there's oil and vinegar and wine, and then a little bit of garum, of course. And that's just, again, it's just quite a simple combination of ingredients. That's a familiar. We've all cooked. We've all prepared kind of dressings and sauces like that. So that was one of the ones I quite liked. That was quite tasty, especially with the mullet. And then there's the other one I made was one that went with one of his pork dishes, which is called ophelai, which kind of means small pieces of meat. So it's probably a pork belly. I think I used a pork belly, and it's dry roasted, and then. Put in the oven, and then the sauce is made out of again pepper, lovage, cumin. Again, cumin comes up in a lot of these recipes, and then liguamin, And then wine or more garum was added. And then, again, that's quite a, it was quite a tasty combination of ingredients. And then the meat was chopped up once it had roasted. Or kind of almost like pulled pork, I think, or slightly kind of sliced into cubes. And then it was all mixed up in this sauce. And that was quite a tasty one as well. It's not quite made the cut in our household as something I cook regularly, but it's the sort of thing I could imagine cooking.
Yeah, definitely.
I mean, it's always quite interesting. I don't know if you found this when you were trying the garum out and cooking the garum. Quite often when you're cooking with the garum, it creates this horrendous stench when you put it in the like a hot pan.
Yeah.
And it quite overwhelms the kitchen quite literally in terms of the smell.
Absolutely.
To the point where you're like, I'm not entirely sure I want to eat this. But then when it comes together with a lot of the ingredients, it just adds this really subtle undercurrent of flavour, which I found quite, that was one of the more interesting things with the sort with a lot of the sauces in Apicius was the was kind of this. Just the flavour combination was interesting in a good way. I don't think I cooked anything that was horrible. Great. It was all surprisingly tasty. Which I probably shouldn't be surprised at. But
well, no, I mean it's a period of 2,000 years afterwards, so tastes and you know the taste buds change, and people yes. the way they cook and they eat change. So yeah, I mean it could have been completely and utterly repulsive, but it hasn't been, and I think it's kind of surprising in a way.
Yeah, it's always a pleasant surprise. I mean, it probably helps that I had this. I was quite self-selecting in terms of what I cooked. I wasn't setting out to cook everything. So obviously I was picking things that looked quite nice. I wasn't, the ones with the brain, you know, the pig brains, I left them to the side, for example.
Mm.
So there was a certain element of, you know, I'd introduced a bias that I was probably going to be picking ingredients that sounded tasty, like the roast pork and sauce. That sounds delicious already. Yes. There was more chance that it was going to be tasty than perhaps if you'd set out to cook everything, which I suspect you might come across a few dishes that you probably would make your stomach turn or might involve literally stomach.
I am a very adventurous person in terms of cooking and eating, so I like most of the things. Yeah, go on about the Patina Pisciana.
Well, I mean, a normal patina, they're probably one of the more popular dishes given how many recipes there are for them. And they tend to be like a, you know, a pan of meat or a pan of vegetables. And then you seem to break the eggs into it and kind of cook it up a bit like an omelette, a bit like a custard. But then the Apician patina, it's something else entirely. I think it definitely involves these, you know, a large amount of meat. It uses cooked udder, it uses fish, chicken, fig peckers, which I think are some sort of like a thrush, you know, like a little bird or something. Probably cooked whole, I guess. And these are all diced up. And then there's all sorts of spices go in there. And then there's eggs, of course, as well. But then the interesting thing about this is after you've cooked all this chopped meat up, and it's layered up in a dish with flatbreads on top between the layers, and it's so much like a lasagna. I mean, apart from possibly the cooked udder and flaked fish, but in kind of concept, this, you know, creating this dish of layers, and doubly so when you realize that the word for these flatbreads is lagana, which just I don't know enough about the history of pasta to know if this is kind of an ancestor of lasagna, but it certainly looks like it is in terms of the concept.
Yeah, certainly. Yeah, it's very interesting. I mean, it kind of almost makes you think that there were things similar to pasta before. So yeah, I think that there was an element that I think ancient Greeks and ancient Romans had that pasta type of things, proto-pasta. And I think it was also invented in China with noodles. So I think we had two different parts of the world that invented this thing.
Kind of parallel evolution. Kind of.
Exactly, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, but I mean, this is one of my... The Apician patina is one of my regrets. That's one of the ones that got away that I didn't get around to cooking. Just because it's quite an ambitious... It's one of the ambitious recipes in there, I think. One of the higher ability ones, I'd have thought.
Yeah, definitely. I think we should try it soon then.
Yes, maybe next time if you do another one of your Roman cookery evenings.
Yeah, I'll have the patina Apiciana in your honor. Yeah.
It's kind of an interesting. I always think Roman cuisine is such a big topic anyway, isn't it? That this is very much, we're talking about Apician Roman cuisine. It's through that kind of middle class, upper middle class aspirational lens, which probably, I suspect, doesn't bear much relation to Roman cuisine in general. But it's certainly, because it's the cookbook that survived, it's the one we end up looking at.
Mm.
There is a cookbook called Roman Cookery. I can't remember who that's by, Mark. Oh, sorry, I've left it across the other side of the room. But that tries to get to Roman cookery beyond Apicius. But right. I think it's such a fascinating topic. And I think people nowadays are quite experimental when it comes to cooking. I think people are a lot more interested in food in general and trying things out than maybe they used to be. And as well, people are quite interested in the ancient world. I think it's quite a good time for people to be trying to experiment with ancient recipes and ancient cuisine. And because we have so much, so many of Apicius's recipes survive and as a result have been studied and interpreted primarily by Sally Granger, it's quite an easy, if people do want to like just try cooking Roman food or one type of Roman food, I think there's worse places to start than Apicius. Maybe they start with the Apician patina, but
yeah, there are plenty of other simpler recipes and accessible, and also the ingredients you can find them nowadays.
You don't even have to go as far as like a deli or a specialist cook shop. But most of the ingredients I found quite happily in Sainsbury's or the local supermarket. It was I did not have to go particularly out of my way to find this stuff, and you have to be quite flexible when it comes to if you're using the original recipe in terms of guessing what quantities. But like I said, Sally Granger has done a fantastic job in a couple of cookbooks now of distilling it down and working out through experimentation how much of stuff to use, and even the like the utensils and equipment used it's stuff you have in your kitchen already. Obviously, the Romans wouldn't have used a fan oven, but
no.
they'd have probably had an oven in some capacity or something that would that will lead to the same end result as sticking it in the oven for half an hour.
Yeah, yeah, I think they did I think it was the ancient Greeks that they invented the oven as we know it, you know, with a closed door and so on. So I'm sure they would have the Romans. Took the concept further and improved it, and for sure they would have plenty. Not every household, obviously, it's something very expensive and very energy consuming, but definitely you would have markets and outdoor food stalls and this kind of places that there will be plenty of ovens for cooking. For masses basically. So yeah, I think it's not million miles away. Most of the stuff that we can do nowadays and compare it to what they did 2,000 years ago. And if you go to the British Museum and see the treasures from different parts of the Roman Britain, and you can see their kitchen utensils and you see what they used and all the tableware and cookware, and almost all of them, they have something familiar, something that fundamentally hasn't changed, really.
Yeah. And I suspect, again, you could probably have a whole episode on Roman dining and Roman dining rooms and dining culture, but fundamentally, part of the fact that they're lying on their fronts, yes, on their sides to eat, the concept of a three-course meal is very familiar to us. The sort of dinner which comes with many different dishes is familiar to us. It might not be how we eat every night, but it's certainly, you know, if you go to out for tapas or for Chinese, the concept of having lots of dishes with lots of different foodstuffs of kind of concoctions,
yeah.
That's quite a familiar concept. That's not an alien thing. It's familiar.
Exactly. Yeah.
If you kind of turned up at a Roman dining table, you would know what to do. Possibly, mostly.
I suppose they had different names. What was the name for the first course?
Top of my head.
Gustatio. Gustatio.
Yeah, Gustatio. Yeah. Yeah, Gustatio.
And then the main course
is Mensa Primae.
Mensa Primae.
Yeah, and then Mensa Secundae, which was the kind of desserts.
Mm.
So it's as you'd expect, gustatio is the, you know, the first course, and that's the appetizers, the starter, the kind of stuff to cleanse and stimulate your palate,
yeah,
to kind of whet your appetite. Yeah. And the main course, the mensae primae, is that's the main course. That's what you'd expect to get your vegetables and your meat and your fish and all sorts of things. And then the mensae secundae is it's your dessert. It's again quite a familiar. There's something familiar about that as a concept.
Yeah, very familiar. Yeah, exactly. Everything sounds quite modern in a way.
And I don't know how much that is us projecting. You know, it's recognizable to us, so therefore we're kind of homing in on the recognizable stuff and ignoring the stuff that's not familiar, like the dining couches or the
yeah, true, or the watered down wine. I guess that's another thing. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, I suppose. I haven't tried that one. I guess in that respect, I'm barbarian.
You'd be considered a barbarian, I think, wouldn't you? You drink your wine neat, unmixed.
But in my defense, I have always a glass of water next to my glass of wine. So
well, there you go. It's like the spiritual successor.
Yeah. I'm reading now that, diced watermelon dressed with mint and pieces of cheese and bread. I mean, that's something like you'll find as an entree in a
mm-hmm.
canapes in a modern table, really. Watermelon meat, yeah, perfect. It sounds modern.
Yeah, exactly. And there's some of the ones. There's a recipe for it's like eggs. It's a bit like, you know, deviled eggs.
Deviled eggs, and yeah, exactly.
There's very similar things that we use as starters.
I love it.
Yeah,
I don't know. I mean, I find it so fascinating.
I always think it's quite interesting. I've been to a couple of there's a couple of places I've seen. I've never been to one yet. It's one of my goals. And there's a couple of restaurants named Apicius, both in this country and in Italy, and actually in Tokyo. I've happened to walk past them.
Really?
I always think that's quite interesting that there's still that kind of legacy. Of, you know, even though we might not use the word Apician anymore, that concept that Apicius was this gourmand, this kind of, and you know, grand ancestor of haute cuisine that still lives with us, even though it's ever so slightly in the names of a few restaurants here and there. I always find that quite interesting. I always think it was a later Roman writer, a Tertullian, refers to Apicius as the patron saint of cooks. And I was thinking that's quite a nice way of thinking about him, possibly. You know, even if he, for whatever we don't know about him, there's certainly enough smoke that must be, there must be enough fire of that he must in some way have been involved in cookery or gastronomy or cuisine in some fashion for his name to become attached to, you know, the cookbook, and then to have it, you know, this reputation that's survived 2,000 years.
Yeah, exactly.
I could talk about Apicius for great lengths of time. I find him quite an interesting character. And the Roman cuisine, I just find it, it's just interesting. It's one of my kind of pet projects, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, so one of the things, obviously, they had different kinds of vegetables. Obviously, they had onions, but as you said, they had lots of different edible bulbs. You said...
Yeah.
Hyacinth. Yeah. What else did they have? Have you found out really any other interesting edible bulbs that they had?
Yeah. So they ate all sorts of bulbs really. So quite a few of the flowering bulbs that we wouldn't eat anymore. So the bulbs of the lily and the squill. The squill. Do you think so?
Yeah.
Certainly in some varieties are edible. I don't want to say that all lily bulbs are edible, but and then of course they'd use like garlic bulbs would still crop up in Roman cooking, I think. And then the grape hyacinth is the type of bulb that gets that they consider an aphrodisiac, which I think is why it was probably the bulb used in that in the recipe for bulbs I mentioned earlier, which talks about Venus.
Yeah.
And they're actually still the grape hyacinth is still used in it comes up as part of Meze in southern Italy and Greece. I think it's Volvi, I think, in Greece, I think it's called.
Yes.
And Lampascioni, I think, is in southern Italy.
You see, you forget these things because obviously I've lived here for so long and, yeah, of course, yeah, now you mention it. I think they had parsnips, right? Parsnips, which I don't think we eat nowadays in Greece, or I don't think I've seen them in Italy either.
No, it's not. You don't tend to associate it, do you, with Mediterranean cuisine? Yeah. Certainly, I think of parsnips as kind of hearty northern dishes. And I think parsnips were they were imported from Germany originally, I think.
Right.
I think it's one of the Tiberius, the second emperor Tiberius, imported parsnips.
It was his luxury or something. Yeah, yeah.
Some of his luxuries leave a lot to be desired, but he had a thing for he had a thing for cucumbers as well, I think. And then carrots were used, but only modern carrots are orange. I think in Roman days carrots would have been purple, or a variety of colours, but they'd have associated purple,
right?
Purple carrots as when you think of a carrot. But yeah, they had a huge range of vegetables, that some of which we'd still recognise and some we probably wouldn't.
Just because
tastes change, I guess.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, yeah, that's another interesting thing that I find with ancient Roman and Greek cuisine, that you have all these things that they fell out of fashion and then they crop up somewhere else, and then maybe there's a little local place that they still do it, but you haven't heard of, and then somebody else says, oh, yeah, but it's still going on.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, of course.
Did you find, with Lucanicae, for example, did you... Because that crops up in Apicius quite a few times. Did you find they were quite familiar when you... Because you made them, didn't you?
Yeah. Mm. Not all the ingredients. Not all the ingredients, but certainly the use of leek and pepper was extremely familiar. Something that, you know, it was part of most of the sausages that I eat from Greece. Or when we do it in Greece, you know, the traditional village sausages, they're with leek, black pepper, pork meat, and yeah, smoked, you know, or cured for a few days and so on. So that was very, very familiar. It was something that it wouldn't be out of place in some small village in Greece or southern Italy for that matter.
Yeah, one of the most extreme lengths I went to for when I was researching this project was I did a butchery course.
Right.
With a local kind of butchers and charcuterie in Norfolk. So I learned how to make sausages from scratch, but also how to, you know, properly carve up a pig and all sorts of things like that, which was, it's one of the reasons. I wouldn't necessarily advocate going to that length, but there's something about actually getting hands-on with the recipes that I think makes you understand the kind of mindset.
Right.
The people that have written them, the people that were eating them, just because there's an awful lot of difference between us and people that lived 2,000 years ago, but when you're in the kitchen, you're cooking things largely in the same way. You know, you're carving meat or you're preparing meat. It's fundamentally unchanged on a certain level than it was 2,000 years ago. We're still eating with the same, I know we said, you know, tastes have changed, but we're fundamentally eating with the same equipment, quite literally with our tongues, with our taste buds. That, you know, when the recipe is asking for pepper and cumin and parsley and bay leaf and all that sort of stuff, I think it connects us on that kind of across time, because we're experiencing the same thing as they were experiencing, and there's not many things that you can do that with.
No, for sure.
Studying the ancients.
I agree with that totally. I think that's the most fascinating thing, I guess, from you know, studying these recipes and actually cooking them. It connects you with the past totally. It's like a time machine. I don't think there's another equivalent that takes you so close to the ancient past.
No, definitely not, because that experience is so, their experience is so far removed from ours on so many different levels. There's so many different assumptions and contexts that we don't have that they would have had. But even going to ancient Rome or to like a Roman site is so different than, we can't assume that they would have experienced it in the same way that we do, because it's such a long time ago.
Yeah. But
with food, I think it does act as a bridge. It's one of the, I think you're right, it's one of the only things that does connect us so closely in such a, in such an intimate way.
Exactly, yeah, as you say, intimate way, yeah. Fantastic. Thank you so much for joining.
That's okay, thanks for having me.
I hope you're keeping well and staying safe at home.
Yes, mostly spending time in my kitchen, baking and cooking, actually.
Excellent.
Seems appropriate.
Yeah. I think everybody does that now. What else can you do?
Absolutely.
Apart from obviously doing a podcast about food.
Yeah, when we're not cooking food, we're talking about food.
Have a lovely evening.
Yes, you too.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for inviting me on.
You're welcome.
It's good to talk.
Thanks for the podcast
as well. It's a highlight of my podcast diary.
Great. Okay. Have a lovely evening. See you.
I'll speak to you.
Cheers. Bye.
Bye.
And that's all for this week's episodes. Thank you for listening. I've been Thomas Dinas, and this was the Delicious Legacy Podcast. I hope you've enjoyed it, and see you in 2 weeks' time. Remember, if you want exclusive content, the podcast episodes earlier, and ad-free, join me on Patreon under the Delicious Legacy name. Here, for just $3 per month, you can have all the above. This way, you'll help me create the episodes faster, release them quicker, and concentrate more on researching other interesting subjects from the ancient world. Additionally, you will get straight to your inbox lots of exclusive material, such as recipes, images, and other tailor-made content. Thank you for listening, and goodbye.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.